Short disclaimer. This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldon. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted,
the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat.
Welcome to episode 190 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander. This week on the Relong, we are discussing chapter 38, entitled, I Meet a Lawyer.
So, Jamie's GSW is healing up. His fever is gone. Them bacterial killers, those penicillin little things, those anti-germs, work really well. Jenny had been staying away for the last few days. Of course, it's her house. She knows what's going on, but she's stayed out of Claire's hair and out of Jamie's hair.
Rightfully so.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. No kidding.
It's like the first time since they got back to Lallybroch that she was out of their business.
Claire takes a little break and she goes upstairs to tend her own toilet, and she finds she had been left the good soap. Now that tells her how Jenny feels about her presence. I'd never before, and again, I know I've read this multiple times, but I never took notes before about this. So what I wrote was, I'd never before thought of a bar of soap as an insult. Oh gosh. Like, could you, I mean, I've heard of, like, you know, where your place, like if you have a lot of, you know, where your place at the table, right? The honored guest, maybe at the foot of the table, at the head of the, one of the heads of the table, you know, given the best china, given the first service or served first, you know, we've heard of a lot of things, but I've never considered the soap that you're given.
Well, I imagine if I had to make all of the soap in my house, I would keep the cheap soap for me and my kid. And then if we had guests, give them the nice soap so that they knew that they were well thought of. And
that is true. But the fact that she gave her the well thought of soap was kind of a twist.
Well, yeah.
So, I mean, so by not giving her the family soap, she was telling her she wasn't family.
Right. But had it been anyone else, I mean, had she not, God, I can't even put a sentence together. Had she not previously spent time in that household,
she wouldn't have known
Jenny as quote unquote family. She would never have known that this was such a slight, but having lived there before and having known the living conditions they lived in, you know, it was became quite apparent to her the standing she had in the household.
Yeah. So Lisa T writes, while Claire is a guest, she is still an Outlander at Lallybroch, or at least to Jenny. This also reminds me of Claire having to prove herself to Mother Hildegard at L'Hôpital des Anges in Dragonfly and Amber. Claire accepts the challenge. A mob of kids arrive, and when she walks into the room where Jamie was, they're surrounding him. She hears Jamie proclaim, there she is! It's young Jamie and his brood. He hands over his baby, Benjamin, to Claire. The kids ask questions about Claire, about her age, about how she's a witch, and about how she has no warts. Two of the wee ones get into a row, and Jamie acts as referee. Ah, children, how brutal and honest they are. About how one was like snot-nosed, and the other has something else. And she's like, well, it's true. It's not a lie. It's true. And he's like, yeah, well, it's not that nice. Poor kids, they really have it hard because they're told not to lie. Now, granted, they're also told to be nice, but when someone says something that's the truth, but it's not very nice, then kids are very literal, right? So even if they're saying something out of anger or out of frustration, and they say the truth, and then they get in trouble for it, it's like, well, you know, I'm not lying. So it's kids have so much to learn, like gradations of, yes, you want to tell the truth, but you also don't want to hurt someone's feelings. And that's, I think, where kids, that besides that and sneaking cookies, that's where kids learn to begin to lie.
I just love their standards of what makes a witch.
Oh, the nose and the warts, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
you don't have any warts on your face.
So the kids want Jamie to tell them a story, and he begins to tell them the story of Saint Bride and the geese. And the baby that Claire is holding, wee Benjamin, starts to root. And Claire's like, I'm out of here. I am not this. I cannot help you with this. We are going to go find his mother. Eileen P. writes, don't you love Nunky Jamie? It's so nice to see Jamie surrounded by adoring children. He is so good with them. Another thing to love about Jamie Fraser. Too bad Brianna missed out. Lisa T. writes, Claire finds that she is a bit of a legend to the young residents of Lallybroch. So funny. But again, Claire is assured of her youthful looks and of her reputation as a witch. To settle an argument between the children, Jamie agrees to tell a story. Just as in chapter 37, we were reminded of Romeo and Juliet. Jamie tells a story of geese that mate for life. Both stories remind us of the pain and grief that Jamie and Claire suffered over the past 20 years, but with one difference, they survived. Claire goes to find wee Benjamin's mother, and she goes into the kitchen where she finds her. And
hang she's on. In. Just 1 second. Wouldn't you say that they did do like the geese and grieve themselves separately? To death? Yeah, I mean, not to a literal death where they perished, but to a death where they weren't really living.
Oh, yeah.
So, I mean, I think even though it wasn't Romeo and Juliet-esque, I think that they were definitely geese-esque in their the way that they survived each other, quote unquote.
Well, then you could take it even further. I don't know about Jamie, but for Claire, you could almost say going through the stones was like a rebirth, the second time at least. The first time it was pure horror, but the second time was like a rebirth.
Well, that would be your third time.
Ah, coming out this side was a rebirth. So she's introduced to the women in the kitchen, and no one seems surprised that Jamie's first wife had returned from the dead, or France, whichever.
Sorry, that made me laugh. That makes me laugh every time. You know, from the dead or France, whichever it is.
But they didn't ask
her
any
questions. They're very similar.
They're far away and unknown, and we're never going to go there. And if we do, death is less of a wonder than France, because we're all going to go there. But they didn't ask her any questions, and they spoke in Gaelic around her. And she notes that Jenny is still absent. So Jenny and Claire were basically kind of not on purpose, but very conveniently ish avoiding each other, it seemed. But there is a reckoning to be made, Diana writes. So Claire wanders out to the dairy shed to get a pitcher of cream for the women in the kitchen. And she sees Fergus leaning against the fence. Now, this is a fence that is part of the sheep's pen. And the sheep out there, they're Merino. Jenny's very prized babied Merino sheep for their wool. And they're loud and annoying and very spoiled. And they expect to be fed. Fergus throws, he's very annoyed at them, and he throws a whole cabbage head at their leader, the dude, whose testicles Diana insists on describing quite a few times, how they're large and dangly, and they like almost hit the ground.
I've seen goats like that.
It was,
Well, you know what? I've seen goats like that for sure. I was trying to think if I've ever seen sheep like that, and usually I don't see a lot of sheared sheep. So there's usually a lot of wool and fur covering. So I don't know that I've ever consciously noticed a sheep's balls.
That's good to know.
I've seen goats, like I said, but you know, I don't know. I have seen
was it
animals
you?
With large testicles.
It was you. Yes, you have. Wasn't it you in our story? I don't know if it was the Merwink episode or what, but I think it was Lene was with us. You were talking about how the first time you saw like a letdown horse thing, and
medieval times.
You didn't even know what it was. You were like,
no, I knew what it was.
Oh, you did? I thought you said you
it
didn't
just
know
had a mind
was.
Of its own. I couldn't believe it. It looked like it was. Like a prehensile. Oh, like Lord. It had its own little brain. I mean,
like
I guess
dolphins.
They do.
Oh, like they can go, like it moves by itself.
Yeah, it looked like it was waving. Or like, and that it was trying
dolphins
to
are scary too. Specific. apparently dolphins, like, oh my gosh, I've read not just, well, humans too, but dolphins apparently have raped humans, females, I think mostly, maybe males. I don't know about that. But also male dolphins are really terrible to, like, female dolphins. I was reading this scientist's description of their observations, and down, I think it was in, I think it was off of the coast of Florida. I could be wrong. Anyway, it was a book about animal behavior and intelligence about all these different animals and how each animal, you know, kind of, they were superstars in their own way in different areas. Oh my gosh. And it was like, it was an audiobook. I was like, I almost couldn't listen. I was like, really? This is awful. Anyway, so I'm digressing, but back to the sheep testicles.
I agree, but I think on that note, we need to stop having the whole dolphin experiences where everyone's like, I want to ride a dolphin. You know what? Now they want to ride you back. So maybe we should stop.
They don't want to ride you back. They want to ride you front.
Ride you back.
There you go.
Is what I said.
They want to ride you, period.
They want to have their own ride.
Oh gosh. So these loud, noisy, that's redundant. These loud, spoiled animals end up running off. He throws the cabbage and, like, hits the leader. I forget the dude's name. He had a cute little name. But the testicle dude. Fergus hits. Okay, hi, baby. My cat just came onto my lap. Fun times.
I think he should just be named Testicle Dude.
Testicle. Is that what I said?
His name was Huey, but you said Testicle Huey. Dude.
I think we need to tell Diana. Diana, we have a new name for your sheep in chapter 38 of Voyager. Just name him Testicle Dude, since you were pretty much doing that anyway. Fergus throws a head of cabbage at him, and he's like, what? And he runs away, annoyed. And his harem, basically, all of his lady friends, follow him away. Fergus hasn't told Jamie that he's back yet. And he seems distracted. It turns out that Jamie was right when they had escaped the coast in Edinburgh after the bad rendezvous that was not a very good rendezvous. Turns out he was right. There were customs men waiting for them back at the tavern in disguise. And Fergus is depressed that Jamie's business won't turn around very quickly. He had invested, we find out, into a small part of the printing business. And he had hoped in time to make some money off of that and to become a full partner. Because, Summer, you want to share with the listener why he's bummed, but why he wanted to get on in with the printing biz?
He's got a lady friend that he's trying to impress her parents.
So does this make him Testicle Dude?
He's testy for sure.
I'm sorry, César. We will not do this to you again. Oh, yes, he is testy here. He is testy here. Yes. And it's very sweet. I mean, it's real for him, but it's sweet. Fergus is a character of our heart, I think. So his worry is that whereas printing is a respectable business, smuggling, anything else that comes with it, is not. He wants to woo and to wed. Claire thinks, quote, I couldn't say I blame the young lady's mother, all things considered. And this is, of course, in response to Fergus saying, me being a smuggler, you know, not only is it not respectable, and it's not, well, it probably would bring money, but it's not respectable. I would never have a chance with this lady's mother, basically. So Claire thinks
he doesn't want a chance with her mother. He just
needs to woo. He needs to actually convince the mother too, or the person. Yes. Which we don't know who it is. We don't officially. Well, we know who it is, but we're not going to announce that yet. I mean, we know who it is. Claire thinks, quote, I couldn't say I blamed the young lady's mother, all things considered. While Fergus was possessed of dark good looks and a dashing manner that might well win a young girl's heart, he lacked a few of the things that might appeal somewhat to more conservative Scottish parents, such as property,
like a hand,
income, a left hand, and a last name, unquote. Diana is just so dry as she slips it in there. That's why it makes it even more funny.
Claire doesn't seem to have a very high opinion of the disabled and what they can do. Because, like, Ian, she's like, he does very well with one leg. And then, like, Fergus, she's like, Don't tell me you had a hand in the print, a hand. Don't tell me you had a hand in the print business. Like, they're clear. But surely you weren't helping Jamie at all. Well, and he's like, no, I just funded
it a little bit.
Yeah. And I'm like, he could do more. He's handy capable, not handicapped.
And don't forget, he remained French. He would, like Claire, always be an outlander. Lisa T. writes, remember that passage for future chapters and books, for that matter. So all of the stuff that goes against or speaks against Fergus as a mate for a young, conservative, respectable Scottish lady's or woman's daughter.
I find that term laughable.
Lady?
Conservative.
Hey, it was Diana's term, not mine.
I know. Well, that's just because from Claire's brain, she doesn't know who it is. But knowing who it is, I'm like, conservative. Really?
Yeah. Oh, well, yeah. Jamie does not know of Fergus's intentions, let alone the girl he has set his heart on. Girl he has his heart set on. Sorry. Sorry, other native English speakers. I apologize for that one.
He could have, set his heart on her physically.
Exactly, because he'd be dead. So Jenny is in the room with Jamie when Claire goes back. Jenny is trying to get Jamie to leave before a man named Hobart McKenzie arrives. Jamie says he is not afraid of him. Hobart, we find out, is Larry's brother. She has sent for him and told him about all the stuff. Now they end up agreeing, fine, Jamie will stay, but he will not, quote, make a mess on her good turkey carpet. And by make a mess, what made me laugh was turkey carpet. But what by make a mess, she means, like, don't kill anybody, please. Don't get blood on my stuff.
Well, I think Diana is very good at naming her characters. And if you've given a dude a name like Hobart, you probably have nothing to fear of him.
Well, yeah, that's funny. Jamie's hungry. Claire goes to get Jamie's breakfast, but sees Jenny going out to the barn. And she follows her, since it might be her best chance to actually get her to speak alone. So speak alone with her. Jenny had been going out there, she tells Claire, to tell young Ian to unsaddle Donis, who is the grand horse of Donis. That would be a mighty old horse, although horses can live like 30 years old.
Yeah, but they wouldn't have saddled him.
Oh, no, that's true.
If it was a 30-year-old horse, they wouldn't have been like, saddle the oldest horse we have and ride him off and hopefully
you'll escape. Okay.
Who may or may not have a gun.
They go out to the barn. Is that what a barn? The barn? Stable. They go out to the stable, and in order to tell young Ian to unsaddle Donis, and as they get there, he's just waking up from a nap. He tells his mom that he came out, but didn't think it worth the trouble to saddle him, only to have to unsaddle him. So young Ian knows his uncle and knows the situation. Hmm. That was funny. Martina P. writes, I adore how young Ian once again has disobeyed orders by not even bothering to saddle Donis because he was entirely certain that Jamie would not run from Hobart McKenzie. That's
like
a nephew.
I said, nobody runs from a dude named Hobart.
That's a nephew you know knows his uncle, and I simply adore this relationship. Not for long, Martina. She sends him back, young Ian, to the house to get breakfast for Jamie and for himself, a second breakfast for himself. And Claire and Jenny go to the root cellar. I wonder if there is any symbolism of going into the earth. Maybe Jenny, in chapter one, in season one, I mean, not so much season two, at least the read-along, but in season one, Jenny is, season two too, I think, or book two, Jenny is referred to, if not explicitly, then implicitly, as kind of the Earth Mother, right? The one she's there, she's holding space, she is Lallybroch, right? That is her manner, regardless of the fact that her son's the heir now, or the owner, or that her brother was Laird before. It is because she was older and she helped raise Jamie and is raising her kids. That is her home, and she is basically queen of that manor. And so she is boss lady, basically. So to literally be kind of like the Earth Mother, the one who, you know, and especially in the scene where she's giving birth and all of that, she's so earthy. And here they are literally going down into the earth. So I thought that was very, I thought it was, it's almost hard for it not to be symbolic in some way. So Jenny tells Claire that it was her suggestion, Claire's, to plant potatoes that allowed them to survive years even after Culloden. Jenny says that Jamie wouldn't have married Leary, she admits this fully, if it hadn't been for her. She says she made him do it because she knew how lonely he was. And she tells Claire that Jamie is not the sort of man who should sleep alone. Lisa T. writes, "We begin to understand Jenny's motives. She watched her brother suffer and grieve, and she blames Claire." Martina P. writes, "While Claire's alienation from Jenny is quite difficult for me to read, and I spend a great deal of time being angry at Jenny, she has my total forgiveness after we get her explanation and consequently their reconnection." But Claire wants to know why Jenny sent for Leary. After they came back from Edinburgh, Jenny says that when Ian had told her she was back, she was gobsmacked. At first she was excited, and then afraid. She saw Claire at Jamie's wedding with Leary, literally in person, the figure of Claire. Claire was there at his left hand between him and Leary, and she knew that she would take him back. Jenny says that she was not born with the sight, but she did see Claire there. And it scared her so much, she actually had to leave leave the ceremony. Jenny had hoped that it had been long enough without Claire, these 20 or probably at that point, what, maybe 17, 15, 16, 17 years, that he could be happy with someone else. And she knows that Jamie is a faithful person, period. So once he'd sworn himself to Leary, he wouldn't leave her. He would never leave her wholly. Like, even if they didn't get along and he left, he would never leave her uncared, her and her family uncared for. But then Claire came back. Lisa T. writes, "Jenny is starting to prepare breakfast. Claire follows her to the root cellar, an interesting place for a confrontation, but it is the turf that they have in common. They are equal there." Eileen P. writes, "Jenny's vision of Claire during the wedding ceremony of Jamie and Leary is interesting. Jamie is connected to Claire through dreams. I wonder if the sight runs in their family. While I would have interpreted Jenny's vision of Claire as meaning Jamie will always be in love with Claire, Jenny sees it as an omen that Claire will return and take Jamie away from her. That reasoning makes Jenny rather selfish for trying to keep Leary and Jamie together. Claire once noted that Jenny loved Jamie as much, if not more, than she did. I would think it would be better to express that love by allowing Jamie to be with the woman he loves. However, love can be selfish sometimes. In the end, Jenny is practical as ever. She realizes Claire and Jamie are bound together and there is no preventing them from being together."
It doesn't take away the selfish nature of her actions.
Oh, no, of course not. Of course not.
Like, I'm still holding the grudge.
It was selfish the second time. It was not selfish when she tried to have him married off to Leary. That was trying to help her brother. But it was selfish once Claire came back. I think everyone can agree that we don't like him with Leary, but she was trying. And she doesn't. No one knows in the books. No one knows about the witch shiz.
No, so, no one knows about that. But my point is it's selfish of her, yeah, knowing how unhappy Jamie has been,
yeah,
for the entirety of the time, not just the time that he was back after the prison, after Hellwater and single and how miserable he was. But then he got married because she kind of guilted him into it and then continued to be miserable. So miserable that he had to leave and go live in Edinburgh to find any semblance of a life that wasn't draining and horrid for him. So for Claire to show back up and Jenny to be like, I know that you would be happier with that situation. I would be happier if you continued to be a little less happy and here where I can utilize you.
Got it. And that selfishness didn't come into play until Claire came back, correct? Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah, she didn't have any. Here's the thing. He was living in Edinburgh. I know it's not that far from Inverness. I know it's not that far from Inverness. However, he wasn't there at Lallybroch. Yeah. He wasn't there, you know, in her life every day. Claire coming back doesn't necessarily immediately mean that he will be any further away than he already is. I don't think that, even having read the next chapter, I think the intention was not to have it significantly change the current relationship between him and his sister. But she just kind of got all like gloom and doom. What this means is you're going to take him away from me. So I did the only thing I could, which was to try to appease to his honor system.
Yeah.
Which, and to thinking if she pissed Claire off enough, Claire would go back. If she saw that he was potentially happy.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, but was she going to go back? I don't know what she was going to do. I don't know if she knew what she was going to do.
That's true, because she did take off like she was going to go back. But even after, I don't know if it was before or after. I think it was after. But even after young Ian came to get her, to bring her back, she admitted to herself that she had kind of, not stormed off, although she had stormed off. She had left, and she admitted to herself that she was hoping that Jamie would come after her. And I thought it was funny. I don't think I remarked about it last week or last episode, but when they had the major fight in the bedroom, and he's like, stay here, I'll be back, I'll explain everything, or because that happened twice. If someone is truly, and this is, I think this is an early hint of why she wasn't intending to leave. She may have left to save face, but why she really didn't want to leave Jamie. She was just really unhappy with the situation and wanted to be shown that he cared, you know, go out of his way to show that he cared. Mm-hmm. She says, one of the lines, and this struck me, it has never struck me before. She says, I'm leaving. Something, 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 I'm leaving. And opens the door and then walks out. And then, you know, stuff happens. Even if she didn't leave right that moment, she says, she makes a scene. She's part of the scene. She makes a point to say, I'm leaving, or out of my way, I'm leaving. Opens the door and walks out. If someone is, that's drama. That's drama. Understandable, but drama. If you're trying to get away and you don't want someone to run after you or, you know, get in your way or whatever, you don't advertise that you're leaving. You know what I'm saying? You bide your time, and then you get the heck out of Dodge. You don't announce it. If you announce it, you're asking for someone to push back.
No, it's like every time I go to a party, and I learned this from my summers spent in Cherokee working at an outdoor drama in North Carolina. We called it the Cherokee Goodbye because if you went to a party and you reached your limit and you were ready to go, if you said goodbye to anyone, it would take another 30 to 40 minutes before you would actually be able to leave. So you adopted what was called the Cherokee Goodbye, which is when you were ready to go, you snuck out and you left. So nobody saw you going. So you made sure that you were gone and you didn't have to answer any questions. You didn't have to say goodbye 30 times. You didn't have to do any of those things. So if she really wanted to be gone and leave,
she would have left. She would have waited until Jamie. Exactly. She would have waited. Cherokee Goodbye came after the Irish exit, I think. I think so. Yeah, I heard about it. Yeah. Who did I hear about that from? I don't think it was from Chelsea Handler. It was someone I heard about it. It was years ago. But I was like, what? Oh, no. You know, I heard about it. It was Mindy. I think I heard about it in Mindy's book. Mindy, you know what I mean? Mindy, the actress?
Mindy.
No, sorry. Mindy is her show.
Well, her name is Mindy.
That's what I thought. Okay, so Mindy, the Indian actress, right? Indian American actress.
It's like, yeah. It starts with a K, doesn't it?
Yes. I can't remember it, but yes. So she was at a party, and basically an Irish exit is when you just like... Kaling. So an Irish exit is basically when you just duck out because And part of it is because you don't want to, you either don't want to make a scene or you don't want to upset the hostess, because then you got to, if you want to leave and you tell someone you're leaving, then you have to explain why you're leaving. And it, like you said, it can take longer. And then not just that, even though you think you're being nice, you also, not only can it take a long time, but when you say you're leaving, again, I understand wanting to be nice. I do. Because that's me. I feel like I had to say something about, oh, I got to go. Okay, see you later, whatever. But if someone, if it's a big party and you really don't need to, you know, do that, and it's understood, it's not a small, if you have a small gathering of six people, you're going to have to say something. But if it's like 20 people, 30 more, or any, or a big event, you can easily duck out. Because the second you start trying to like go around and say your goodbyes, it's a half an hour, like you're saying, a half an hour later. And what did you get out of that? Number one, you got out of there later. And you got the feeling of everyone telling you goodbye. You, that means you did not want to leave a half an hour ago. I mean, you may have said, okay, I'm ready to start getting ready to go. That's different. So yes, Cherokee goodbye, Irish exit. Claire was not serious. She was serious about wanting a reaction. She was not serious about wanting to leave Jamie for good. I stand by that. I think you're right. So anyway, so ends the discussion about last chapter, or to actually two or three chapters ago, maybe two. Back to 38. Jenny says that she'd never been further than 10 miles from Lallybroch her entire life, but that Claire has traveled extensively. She says to her, quote, "You'll go again. You're not bound here. And he would go with you. And I should never see him again," unquote. So Jenny thought if Claire knew about Leary, she just might leave. And she almost did, kind of, but then Summer and I kind of checked that. Claire came back, and now Jenny understands that he is bound to her. Claire promises to take care of Jamie, even if they do go. Then young Ian comes in and tells them that Homack is there, and he's brought a lawyer. They go and meet Homack. After the introductions, who comes in but Ned Gowan, the lawyer who wouldn't die. I love this meeting. I was like, thank you, Diana. This is such a, I mean, hopefully people, you know, like if they're reading book three, hopefully they liked books one and two. But I just love that he just keeps popping up everywhere. I just love it. And he's not done yet, people. That's all I'm going to say. He says, quote, they kind of reconnect and he's like, Mistress Claire or Mistress Fraser. And she's like, Ned Gowan. And they want to chat. But he's like, yeah. What we got to do, quote, business first, my dear. And then, if you will, I should be most charmed to hear the tale of your adventures. She's like, yeah, we'll get to that. I don't know what I can tell you, dude. When they go back into the parlor, Jamie is on the sofa. Now with several small plaits with silk ribbon hair sticking out. I love those kiddos. Those young girls had braided and his hair and put ribbons in it.
It's like straight out of Rapunzel. Yeah. Tangled.
Ned outlines the situation. Jamie has gotten himself.
Did you notice that was his second, Diana's second reference to Wizard of Oz?
Oh, the gotta go see a wizard?
No, she said Cowardly Lion.
What was the first one?
That was in the previous book.
Oh, I thought you meant like in this chapter.
No, I just mean in the book series.
Yeah, I did notice the Cowardly Lion. That was very sweet.
I remember we were all talking about the time period as to whether or not that was an appropriate reference.
Came out in 39.
For her time period. Yeah, no, it did. We looked it up.
Jamie has gotten himself into a bit of legal difficulty. He says, Ned says, Claire could bring suit against him for adultery and criminal fornication. And he looks at Claire and looks back at Ned and says, quote, I think I'm not so worried by that possibility. What else? Unquote. So with regard to Leary, Jamie could be charged with bigamous misconduct, intend to defraud, felonious misrepresentation, ... But what does Leary actually want? Well, she literally wants him castrated and disemboweled and his head mounted on a stake, but that is not going to happen. But she definitely does not want him back as a husband. So that's actually thankfully one good thing. Lisa T. writes, Leary is unnecessarily vengeful. Looking forward to Nell's performance as Leary. She does a great job making her the character you love to hate. Martina P. writes, What a pleasure to meet Ned Gowan again. He is representing Leary. I refuse to call her Mrs. James Fraser. Don't ever say that again, anyone. And able to help to get Jamie out of his legal difficulties. Nobody makes the legal complications sound so humorous as Ned Gowan. So the crux of it is Jamie is willing to pay and keep taking care of her, Leary, and the girls, but only until she's remarried. Lisa T. writes, I found this a fascinating contrast to Claire's discussion at the Abbey in Outlander. There, the issue of having two spouses was a spiritual one and did not present a problem. Claire was absolved. Jamie is not. Now we get down to the settlement, which is the catalyst for the rest of the story. The settlement goes like this. Jamie is to pay Leary £500 in compensation for distress, etc., and also maintain her household at the rate of £100 per year until she is remarried. He'll provide a bride portion for each girl, £300 each, and won't pursue prosecution of her for assault with intent to commit murder. There is that little thing, too.
Right.
Martina P. writes, I love how Jenny steps in and insists that payments will discontinue as soon as she finds another husband. I am sure Jenny, the matchmaker, will be able to be of great assistance. Considering that Leary committed assault with intention to murder, she's at the better end of the bargain. Jamie has to come up with a lot of money.
Yeah, I was kind of incensed that Jenny was the one who thought of that. What the hell are they paying Ned for?
They're not paying Ned. Ned's representing
the other professional.
Dude.
He's the professional. He should have known that and should have thought of that himself.
Well, he's there to be fair, but not to help out. You know what I mean? He's there to help out Homack and Leary, not.
Did you just say Homack?
That's like the third time I said it.
Why haven't I noticed it before?
Because I don't know. I was waiting for you to say something.
I was like, Homack.
Yes, Homack.
Hodor.
Eileen P. writes, you know how you should always bring a Murta? Well, I think you should always bring a Ned Gowan. Jamie should put the, quote, wicked old rascal on retainer. While I think Jamie was overly generous compensating Leary, at least this is over and done. So they go to eat together, and who brings in the meat but a Mary McNabb?
Oh my God, so awkward.
So awkward. Her gaze lingered on him a moment too long, and this is Claire that is noticing this. Eileen P. writes, ah, Mary McNabb is still there, her gaze lingering on Jamie. It seems like she still remembers having sex with Jamie 13 years ago. Well, who wouldn't? Lisa T. writes, so no sooner is the business with Leary settled, but we get a reminder of Mary McNabb in the cave. Just a wee reminder that Jamie still has some secrets from Claire. And you know what? You and I have read book 8. I don't know that Mary McNabb's secret ever came out.
I don't think it did. But that it's experiences and awkward encounters like that that remind you why you should never poop where you
sleep
eat.
With someone. Oh, that, yeah, exactly. Oh, what, sleep with someone in front of a cave? Yeah, that too, Ginger.
No, just somebody that close to home.
No,
that's like,
yeah, not employed by your family.
No.
Martina P. writes, Claire tells us that Mary McNabb was looking at Jamie a little bit too long, and we get nothing else on the matter. It must be intended as a reminder to the reader that this is yet another piece of Jamie's past that he has not shared with Claire. I do wonder how Jamie was behaving toward Mary when he came back. After all, they shared the most intimate moment humanly possible. I mean, it wasn't just sex. It was sex, but it wasn't just sex. It was intimate in a way that she was giving him a gift and he was taking it willingly from her. So I can see there was intimacy there, but I don't think it was as intimate or the closest he's ever been with another person. I think that was with...
It might have been the closest because it was in a cave. But other than that...
Girl, not physically. Not literally like, I can't move. You're so small in here, I can't move. So they need to get Leary married at once. But they're wondering where Jamie will get all the money to handle this. Ian looks at Jenny and Jamie. Quote, there's only one place, isn't there? Unquote. And I wrote, oh my God, adventure calls.
So they're speaking. How do you write that with that voice?
I don't write that with the voice.
How do you accent that to know that that's how you're supposed to say it?
I didn't know. It just happened. A lot of caps,
though. It's no fun. You need to come up with a new way.
A font with voice instructions.
Yeah. How do you font that?
That was like a Muppet thing.
Well, then how do they're you font speaking? Your Muppet sounds?
You mean how do I Muppet fonts? Muppet font? Muppet font? Muppet sound fonts?
Yes. That is exactly what I mean.
They are speaking of the jewels and the money in the treasure chest on the third island, of course. But Jamie wants to take young Ian, not just because he's a good swimmer. I mean, obviously that helps, but Jamie can't swim really well or at all due to his arm. Claire's a little confused, and he tells her it's the treasure that he told her about, the seal's gold. After he'd hidden it, we learn, he'd crafted a letter to Jenny and Ian, heavily encoded. He said that they didn't think the money would be badly spent on helping Lallybroch to survive. So Ian had taken young Jamie to the island. They'd gone together. Young Jamie had swum to the island, taken 2 gold coins and 3 small gems and put the box back. 3 times since, they had gone back to make use of the treasure. Only Jenny, Ian, and their 2 older boys knew about the treasure and its location. Jenny still says that young Ian cannot go. They'd have to leave Scotland and go to France and stay away for a bit. They couldn't stay with Leary. Couldn't stay there with Leary in the area.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure Leary won't let them stay with her.
No, I mean, they couldn't stay there at Lallybroch with Leary so close. Not with the settlement, not with things ending right then the way it is. And he says that Jarrett's offered more than once to take him into his firm. Maybe they'll go to France. They finally get permission to take young Ian. Jenny says, quote, "I suppose it's best we give him his freedom while he still thinks it's ours to give," unquote. That's kind of ironic, seeing as what happens in the next chapter and then the rest of the book, giving him his freedom, it kind of happened to be the opposite.
Well, no. They gave him his freedom. What he did with it was his own business once
He didn't do it. Someone else took him and took his freedom away from him. That's what I'm saying. To be given your freedom, only to have it taken away. That's why I'm saying. Lisa T. And he did not take his own freedom away. Lisa T. writes, "This rite of passage brings to mind another rite of passage for the Murray sons, that of going to the brothel with Fergus." Young Ian has done that, too. So it truly is his turn to swim for the treasure. As opposed to swimming for the pleasure.
No.
Yes. Or is it, yes?
I don't know. How'd you spell it?
All caps. Oh, gosh. Lordy. Again, exiled to France. Just when Claire thought she was home, she is starting a new voyage. And Martina P. writes, "It seems we have old Ian Murray back. He is very supportive and is in favor of young Ian going along and swimming to the island where the treasure is hidden."
Baby. And that was chapter 38. Join us next time when we discuss chapter 39, entitled Lost and By the Wind Grieved.
Thank you, as always, so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode. Thank you to our generous partner, Zencastr, who offers high-fidelity podcasting. Check out Zencastr and use coupon code OUTLANDER20, OUTLANDER20, for 20% off 3 months or 20% off for a year. Connect with us. Visit our website at outlanderpod.com. Find us on Facebook, facebook.com/outlanderpod. We'd love for you to join our Facebook community at outlanderpod.com/group. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at outlanderpod.